From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, 26 dead and hundreds injured as a violent surge in Ukrainian protests takes over the capital. We have the latest from Kiev.
You can see the fires are still burning. It's important to realise that those fires were started and are being fed by the protesters as protection against the police.
President Obama flies into Mexico for his annual North America summit. Our correspondent has the details. We look at the major international effort to end the illegal wildlife trade. And as an 84-year-old nun is sentenced to nearly 3 years in prison for breaking into a nuclear weapons plant, we hear from her fellow activist.
It's hard, especially if you're older. The prison system doesn't treat anyone kindly, and especially older folks. So it will be hard, but they knew what they were getting into.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych has announced a truce with opposition forces to end fatal clashes in Kiev. A statement on the president's website announced that negotiations between Yanukovych and opposition leaders will follow. Earlier, the Ukrainian government announced the launch of what it calls a massive anti-terrorist operation across the country, after violent clashes with protesters in the capital, Kiev, left at least 26 people dead and nearly 250 injured. Daria Bandarchuk reports from Moscow.
The anti-terrorist operation means more strict security measures and cordons on the roads and in the streets of the Ukrainian capital. Military troops also may be involved in keeping stability in the country, according to the Ministry of Defense statement. According to recent reports, some 1,500 firearms and 100,000 bullets went missing over the last 24 hours across the country. The authorities say they may end up in the hands of radical groups and turn up in Kyiv shortly.
In response, American and European leaders warned that urgent sanctions may be necessary. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reiterated that the United States is open to imposing sanctions on Ukraine. Here's Kate Fisher from Washington.
It's been reported that John Kerry is expected to reiterate that the United States is open to imposing sanctions on Ukraine, a threat the Obama administration first made more than 2 months ago. U.S. officials have previously said they were reluctant to impose sanctions, preferring to seek a diplomatic solution. The political crisis erupted last year when Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych spurned a trade deal with the EU and instead accepted a $15 billion Russian bailout.
U.S. President Barack Obama is facing tricky questions at a one-day summit in Mexico. From his Mexican and Canadian counterparts on a raft of stalled trade, energy, and immigration issues. The meeting of North American leaders in Toluca, Mexico, is likely to be frosty, amid frustration over the lack of progress on the Keystone XL pipeline, immigration reform, and trade talks with Asia. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The so-called Three Amigos summit comes as the Obama administration attempts to wrap up key negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership known as the TPP, involving 12 countries, including Mexico and Canada. Critics say the lack of progress on trade issues reflects the U.S. administration's lack of commitment. President Obama has faced pushback from congressional Democrats in his efforts to fast-track trade deals without Congress amending them. And there are fears that without those fast-tracking powers, there'll be a significant delay to the trade agreement with Asia. The focus of the summit in Mexico is economics and trade, but the issue of energy, especially the development of the Keystone pipeline, also tops the agenda.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Cossacks acting as part of the security forces in the Sochi Winter Olympics in Russia have publicly whipped members of the protest rock group Pussy Riot. On Monday, two members of the group were arrested and reportedly beaten before being released. Pussy Riot is known for their vehement criticism of President Putin. Two band members were released from jail in December. The number of new homes being built in America has dropped dramatically, according to new data. Particularly wintry conditions felt across much of the country is being blamed for the slowdown. And there's been mixed economic news out of Britain after data showed the unemployment rate edged up to 7.2% in the quarter to December, easing pressure on the Bank of England to raise interest rates. However, Prime Minister David Cameron welcomed the figures, trumpeting the fact that there was a fall of 125,000 in the jobless figure for the same period. And prosecutors in the phone hacking trial of the News of the World newspaper in Britain have told jurors that former British Prime Minister Tony Blair offered to be an unofficial advisor to the former News of the World newspaper editor, Rebecca Brooks. Wrapping up its case, the prosecution said Mr. Blair told Brooks to tough up and consider taking sleeping pills. UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has the story.
Prosecutors showed an email to the Old Bailey, which they say was sent to James Murdoch, the then News International executive chairman, in July 2011, the day after the final News of the World was published. In it, Mrs. Brooks said Tony Blair, who she'd spoken to 6 days before her arrest, was available to her, James and Rupert Murdoch as an unofficial advisor. The email allegedly summarising Mr. Blair's advice included a recommendation to publish a Hutton-style inquiry, a reference to the death of government weapons advisor Dr. David Kelly. He allegedly advised her to keep strong and definitely sleeping pills.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. At least 26 people have been killed and hundreds injured after a violent surge ripped through ongoing protests in the Ukrainian capital. Kiev's Independence Square has been the scene of bloody clashes and burning barricades as anti-government protesters exchanged Molotov cocktails with security forces. Speaking from Mexico, President Obama condemned the violence and warned of consequences if the Ukraine government didn't refrain, echoing an earlier statement from Secretary of State John Kerry.
We are talking about the possibility of sanctions or other steps with our friends in Europe and elsewhere in order to try to create the environment for compromise.
Protests began in November when President Viktor Yanukovych turned his back on an EU trade deal. Amid the ongoing violence, Mr. Yanukovych dismissed the head of the country's armed forces as the political instability continues. Kiev-based correspondent Gulliver Cragg is in the capital and spoke to me about the current situation on the ground.
I'm looking down from the balcony of the Hotel Ukraina, which looks over the square, and you can see the fires are still burning. It's important to realize that those fires were started and are being fed by the protesters as protection against the police, to prevent the police from encroaching further onto the square. And they've protected more than half of the square in that way, but there is water cannon now firing onto a large part of those fires, and I think that they've made a breach in the flames, which should allow the police to cross it, theoretically, anyway. But the protesters are very, very determined to continue defending Independence Square, and there are thousands of them there, though I wouldn't say tens of thousands, and speeches are going on constantly from the main stage in the center of the square.
But is there still active, violent interaction between these sides?
Certainly. We aren't talking about intense clashes taking place at the moment. When I was on the square earlier, I saw a lot of people openly preparing Molotov cocktails and also hacking up the pavement in order to have paving stones, cobbles to throw at police. A little later, I went to the police side of the lines, and it became apparent to me that it's extremely difficult to throw those cobblestones far enough to hit the police, except when they're actually advancing on the protesters. And a lot of cobbles were thrown and didn't hit anybody earlier this afternoon. The protesters' intention to use violence to protect the square from the police is clear, and the police's intention to use violence to try to clear the square is also absolutely clear. But we haven't seen very intense clashes so far anyway this evening. Another thing that I think it's important to stress is that some of the protesters who have been using violence are members of hardcore right-wing organizations. But they are definitely in the minority. And the people I saw this afternoon preparing cobblestones to throw at police were middle-class, middle-aged women.
There was some confusion over who exactly was responsible for this latest upsurge in violence in this ongoing protest, and some debate over the factions making up the protesters. And of course, almost inevitably, you have the blame game about who is responsible and the ultimate goals they're chasing.
Viktor Yanukovych and his government are really pushing the idea that these people are extremists and that they're terrorists, And that is making those who form the majority of the protest movement against Viktor Yanukovych all the more angry. They hate being described as extremists or terrorists, and they feel it's insulting to their reasons for starting this movement in the first place, which, if you remember, was due to Viktor Yanukovych's sudden decision not to pursue his stated policy of pursuing closer ties with the European Union and turn instead towards Russia, which is not considered to be a democratic state. What Ukrainian protesters, in fact, even those who are members of right-wing organizations, have been saying since the start of this movement is that what they want is the rule of law in Ukraine. They want to live in a country where if somebody commits a crime against you, you can call the police and expect the police to sort it out. They're asking for that level of basic kind of rights in society, which they feel that they don't have in Ukraine, and they feel, most of them anyway, that closer ties with the European Union would have helped Ukraine to establish.
And lastly, if I can just ask you, is there a sense in Independence Square from the protesters that you've spoken to that they are waiting for an international reaction to this chaos?
There is absolutely that sense, and there has been for many, many weeks now. As a foreign journalist here, you are asked many times a day, what is your country going to do? What is your country's attitude to this? And Ukrainians have been calling on the European Union and the United States to impose sanctions against Viktor Yanukovych's government for weeks now. From what I'm hearing, those sanctions are going to be imposed very, very soon. The French foreign minister, the Polish foreign minister, and the German foreign minister are all going to be in Kiev tomorrow for talks with their Ukrainian counterpart, Mr. Kozhara, and with the president, Viktor Yanukovych. And I think that unless they manage to wrest very major concessions and a total about turn, really, from the Ukrainian leadership tomorrow, then after that we'll see sanctions.
Kiev-based correspondent Gulliver Cragg. The foreign ministers of France, Germany and Poland are due to meet in Kiev Thursday ahead of an EU meeting in Brussels, when punitive measures are expected to be on the table. Moscow has accused the West of escalating the situation, with President Putin's top spokesman describing events as an attempted coup. For more on the international response to the political unrest, I spoke to Jeffrey Mankov, Deputy Director and Fellow of the Russia and Eurasia Programme at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
We're talking here about targeted sanctions against members of the elite, presumably those who have been implicated in the violence. Normally, what these cover are travel to the EU and financial sanctions. So, freezing of bank accounts, perhaps investigations into where some of the money in those bank accounts came from. I don't gather that Ukrainian elites spend much time or much money in the United States, whereas they do in Europe. At the same time, I think it's important as a gesture of solidarity, I suppose, with the Europeans, especially given the frustrations that the U.S. administration has had about the ineffectiveness of the Europe's approach to dealing with this crisis ever since it began.
We've heard Moscow's interpretation of events in the Ukrainian capital, the suggestion that there's a Western escalation at play. And Dmitry Peskov, Vladimir Putin's press secretary, he actually said that there was an attempted coup occurring in Kiev. We shouldn't be too surprised by these comments.
No, from the very beginning, the Russians have been at pains to paint the protesters as Western stooges on the one hand, and as extremists on the other. They've really played up, especially the role of the far right in some of these protests, likening them to neo-Nazi groups and some of the Ukrainian partisan organizations that were active during the Second World War. And the Russian government has also said on numerous occasions that this whole thing is being financed and directed by the West, and that the West is using the prospect of this association agreement with the EU as a way to expand its geopolitical space at Russia's expense, and that therefore the protesters are agents of the West.
It was announced on the Ukrainian presidential website earlier today, Wednesday, that Mr. Yanukovych had dismissed the head of the armed forces. How significant a move is that, and what has been the military role in these protests since they kicked off in November?
Potentially, it could be significant. I mean, the army has said that it was not going to get involved in all of this, and that it was sort of up to the politicians to sort out the problems. Now, to what extent that was the preference of the single individual in charge of the army, and to what extent that reflected broader sentiment within the armed forces is hard to say. But certainly, replacing the head of the military at a juncture like this, I think, is a signal that the government didn't trust, doesn't trust the military, and is at the very least, taking steps to ensure that it does not get involved on the side of the protesters, and at the worst, discussing trying to actually bring it into action against them.
This is FSN Reports. President Obama flew down to Toluca, Mexico today for his annual North America summit with the President of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada. With Mexico's recent controversial move to allow foreign investment in their nationalized oil resources and the pending question of the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada to US refineries, energy is sure to be a main topic of discussion. With a final decision on the controversial tar sands pipeline possibly coming in the next few months, the Obama administration faces intense pressure from the Canadian government, fossil fuel corporations, and many members of Congress. But environmental advocates who gathered in Washington today say the president has a strong case for rejecting the project, both politically and morally. Our correspondent Alice Olstein has the details.
When Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper and President Barack Obama hold closed bilateral talks Wednesday afternoon as part of a North America summit nicknamed the Three Amigos, they are sure to discuss the fate of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. The corporation TransCanada has been petitioning the U.S. government for more than 5 years for the right to pipe tar sands from Alberta through the Nebraska sandhills and down to refineries on the Gulf of Mexico. And the pipeline's approval is at the top of Prime Minister Harper's agenda.
Rejecting Keystone XL sends a signal to Canada that we expect them to take their climate commitment seriously.
That's Attorney Anthony Swift with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He and other environmental advocates who spoke in D.C. on Wednesday said President Obama should deny the pipeline's permit. Dan Weiss with the Center for American Progress added that Canada's intense focus on the project disproves a key assumption from the State Department's recent environmental assessment, that the Canadian tar sands will be dug up and transported one way or another.
It raises the question that if there are viable alternatives to the pipeline, why don't they just give it up? Obviously, they don't, because this is the only way to move tar sands oil to market right now. And without it, they have a very dirty, effectively somewhat stranded asset. I think that in any relationship, even a very close one, there are going to be disagreements. And unfortunately, at some point, President Obama may have to say to our closest ally, I'm sorry, we're not going to help you with this one because it's not in our national interest. And frankly, Mr. Prime Minister, it's not in your interest either.
The advocates also pointed to recent speeches and actions by the Obama administration that they interpret as signs that they care too much about the environment to approve the pipeline. In a speech last weekend in Indonesia, Secretary of State John Kerry compared climate change to a weapon of mass destruction. And on Tuesday, President Obama announced the creation of stricter fuel standards for big trucks, a move he said would help break our dependence on foreign oil.
Heavy-duty trucks account for just 4% of all the vehicles on the highway. I know when you're driving sometimes it feels like it's more, but they're only 4% of all the vehicles. But they're responsible for about 20% of carbon pollution in the transportation sector. So trucks like these are responsible for about 20% of our on-road fuel consumption.
The rule won't be fully written until 2015 and won't be implemented until 2016, the president's final year in office. But the speakers Wednesday say the president's passionate remarks on climate in this and other speeches would be incongruous with an approval of the pipeline.
Every time somebody says you can't grow the economy while bringing down pollution, it's turned out they've been wrong. Anybody who says we can't compete when it comes to clean energy technologies like solar and wind, they've had to eat those words.
On March 2nd, thousands of students and activists from all over the country will gather at Georgetown University, the site of President Obama's major speech last year on climate change, and they will march to the White House, where they will hear from farmers and indigenous leaders whose land would be directly impacted by the pipeline's construction. Dan Weiss and Bill Burton with the League of Conservation Voters said the many mass protests held over the past few years showed the energy is on the side of those in opposition to Keystone, and joked that those supporting it have not been as visible.
When you look around the country and you see people who are engaged on this issue, you don't see thousands of people mobilized in the streets in support of Keystone Pipeline.
Bill, I did see several oil executives in front of the White House with signs saying, hell yes, we want a mess. Approve Keystone. So I think there is a little bit of energy on the oil executive side as well.
Thank you for that correction. But they didn't chain themselves to the White House, though.
No, we're kidding. They had their limos pick them up.
The State Department will accept public comments on whether the Keystone XL pipeline is in the national interest of the United States until March 7th. The earliest a decision could come down is late May, but there is no set deadline for the Obama administration to approve or reject the proposal. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
An 84-year-old nun has been sentenced to nearly 3 years in prison for breaking into a nuclear weapons plant in Tennessee. Sister Megan Rice and two others who have also been jailed daubed the walls with biblical references and human blood. The peace activists are all members of the group Transform Now Plowshares. Speaking to FSN's Kate Fisher, Ellen Barfield from the organisation explained why they took this action.
The underlying motivation for the Plowshares movement is the line in the book of Isaiah in the Bible about beating swords into plowshares, that humanity is going to have to move away from the war-making system, from weapons of mass destruction, and turn our war-making activities and the massive amounts of money and human energy they take into life-affirming pursuits. So that's where the idea of transforming the nuclear weapons facility at Oak Ridge and the nuclear pursuits all over the world into life-affirming positive pursuits.
You talk about life-affirming there, but Sister Rice, you know, threw human blood at the walls, which is quite gruesome, really, isn't it?
It can be, yes. It was poured on the walls, not thrown, and there was no one there to possibly be in the way. And the blood is a very strong and frequent symbol in the Plowshares movement and in the peace movement more broadly. It has two very strong and somewhat opposite representations. One is, of course, that war-making in general and nuclear weapons in particular spill massive amounts of human blood. And we, of course, decry that and object strenuously to it. But also, the blood represents our common humanity and our togetherness and our love for each other as human beings, the love that we're trying to encourage and turn toward instead of the hatred and the war-making. So it represents both of those very strong symbols.
Sister Rice is in her 80s.
She's 84, yes, recently turned 84.
It's quite a feat for someone of that age to do something like this.
Yes. And it took hiking up over the ridge, that's why they call it Oak Ridge, because it is the plant is down in a valley, and it is surrounded by ridges on all sides. So, yes, it was pretty strenuous for all of them.
So how is she doing now? She's in prison. How is she coping?
She is tremendously able to be generous and loving and helpful wherever she finds herself, and she did, in fact, talk about some of her colleagues and friends that she's made in jail and the hard time they're having. And even the judge recognized that, yes, we lock up too many people and prison's not a good place for helping anybody. He even said that. Her spirits were very high yesterday. She spoke lovingly and was delighted to get her chance to speak in court, and she was really happy to see all of us there in support of her, about 100 of us. So it was wonderful to see her and wave to her and just, you know, express our love for her and for Michael and Greg also. So all of their spirits were very high. But yes, it's hard, especially if you're older. The prison system doesn't treat anyone kindly, and especially older folks. So it will be hard, but they knew what they were getting into. And, you know, we're sad the sentences are fairly heavy, but we also know they could have been a lot worse. Mike and Amigo and Greg have all talked to elected officials, talked to civic groups, done a lot of other things, too. It's not just that they go out and do this apparently far out on the edge thing, but something this strong makes it very clear how important it is to all of us to object to the horrendous atrocity against the whole human race that nuclear weapons are.
Ellen Barfield talking to FSN's Kate Fisher. And finally tonight, nearly 50 countries have signed a declaration promising cooperation on ending the illegal wildlife trade. At a major conference in London, assembled governments have emphasised that urgent action must be taken to combat the trade in products such as rhino horn and elephant tusk. Among other measures, the countries agreed to treat the illegal wildlife trade as an organised crime, such as drugs or people trafficking. It comes after the UK warned illegal ivory trade activity worldwide has more than doubled since 2007. Rhino horn, it says, is now worth more than gold or platinum. Ollie Barrett has been at the conference in London.
Royal support in London for a conference attended by 46 countries, the highest level international poaching summit ever, co-hosted by Britain's Prince Charles.
Today, the government leaders assembled here will sign the London Declaration, committing to several bold new steps forward, including new pledges to address what is the most significant problem, in my view, that of demand for and consumption of specific products from critically endangered wildlife.
And a sense of optimism that global cooperation can make a difference from Oriam Henry Okello, Uganda's foreign minister.
Things are changing not only in Africa, but also in Europe and the rest of the world, including China, as to attitudes towards ivory trade and rhino horns.
A London declaration saw countries in attendance agreeing a series of commitments, including that poaching and trafficking should be treated as serious organised crimes in the same way as the drugs and arms trades. Mark Simmons, UK Minister for Africa, told me the talks made an impact.
There's a real determination to make a positive difference, both in terms of providing international cooperation and coordination and protecting the species in Africa, but also to try and make a difference for those countries that provide the demand side.
China and Vietnam were here crucially. Can you rely on their support after the conference is finished?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the Asian countries have played a significantly positive role in ensuring that this conference is a success. The Chinese, for example, have destroyed ivory stockpiles in China. And there are discussions ongoing to try and ensure their cooperation in future implementation.
The British hosts feel this conference has been a success, commitments made, but the difficult bit will be making sure they are adhered to. The hard work starts now. Ollie Barrett, London.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. FSN Reports returns on Thursday with news and features from the US and our bureaus around the world. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.